Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has demonstrated for years now in the United States Congress an extraordinary degree, not only of intelligence, but of leadership and courage and conviction, particularly as an outspoken and influential conservative, is our first guest. He is Congressman Jim Jordan. He represents with great distinction the people of Ohio's 4th Congressional District. He serves on the House Judiciary Committee and also on the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which he chairs, among other things, its Subcommittee on Healthcare. First of all, let me just say how delighted I am to have him with us, the founder of the House Freedom Caucus, its first chairman, a great American. So, Congressman, welcome. It's good to have you.
It's good to be with you today, Frank. Thanks for all the good work you do.
Thank you. Well, let me talk to you about one of the projects you've been leading on with two of your colleagues, the current chairman of the Freedom Caucus, Congressman Mark Meadows, and Jody Heiss, and that is this question of the investigations that have been mounted of Donald Trump and some of his lieutenants and his campaign and now the transition and administration. You've called for investigating the investigators. Talk a little bit about why that's needed, sir.
James Comey testified under oath just a few weeks ago that he misled the American people. He did it at the direction of the Attorney General. He did it willfully, intentionally. Think about it. He had the Attorney General of the United States tell the FBI director, go tell the American people something that's not accurate. When she told him, call the Clinton investigation a matter, not an investigation. That should not happen in this great country, but it did. James Comey knew it was wrong, and yet he did it anyway. And then this year, he misleads the American people when he furthers the perception that President Trump is under investigation when, in fact, he wasn't and had been told 3 times by the FBI director himself that he wasn't under investigation. Yet we got to have a special counsel to investigate President Trump when everyone knows that according to testimony, that he didn't obstruct justice, there was no collusion, and yet he gets a special counsel to look into this Russia situation, look into the president, and James Comey's allowed to mislead the American people twice.
Yeah. Well, and the other piece of that, which you've also warned about, of course, was the fact that he also copped to leaking the information designed to create a special counsel who, lo and behold, turns out to be one of his best buddies, Bob Mueller, which gives rise to another question, sir, in your efforts to hold these guys accountable. Doesn't that constitute a disabling conflict of interest for Mr. Mueller as he's pursuing an investigation engineered in this fashion?
Well, it sure raises some real concern. I mean, you're exactly right. James Comey gets fired. He then decides, I'm going to leak a government memo through a friend of the New York Times with the stated objective. He said this under oath to create momentum for a special counsel. And of course, not just any special counsel, Bob Mueller, his friend, his predecessor, his mentor. And now we have this special counsel with Mr. Mueller, in fact, heading it up. And what I also like to point out, we pointed this out in our op-ed, remember a few years ago when an agency with a little bit of influence over Americans' lives, an agency with the power of the Internal Revenue Service, was caught targeting conservatives. We did the resolution in the House 3 years ago calling for a special counsel there. And then Attorney General Holder said, oh, no, can't do it there, even though the lead agent at the Justice Department in charge of investigating the case was a lady named Barbara Bosterman, and she was a max-out contributor to President Obama's reelection campaign. Nope, can't have a special counsel there. And then last year, when numerous members of Congress called for a special counsel in the Clinton investigation, Loretta Lynch said, nope, not going to do it there, even though she had met with Bill Clinton on the tarmac 3 days before Secretary Clinton was interviewed. Can't have a special counsel there. But now, when it's about James Comey and him getting fired, we got to have a special counsel I mean, this is what drives Americans crazy, because it's supposed to be equal treatment under the law, and this sure doesn't look like it.
Well, especially the conduct of the Clinton administration. But let me switch gears here, if I may. And again, our guest is Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio. As a member of the Judiciary Committee, I'm sure you've been troubled, as have I, by the fact that this double standard has enabled a completely blind eye to be turned to investigations that clearly are in order of actual, demonstrable, documented collusion between folks who happened to be Democrats in high office at the time, notably Barack Obama, who asked Vladimir Putin to give him space in the course of the 2012 election, and Hillary Clinton, who was using her foundation, it seems, to launder money for a pay-to-play scheme for, you know, donors that are getting uranium deals and building a Silicon Valley for Russia, for heaven's sake. Where are the investigations of those?
There are all kinds of things we should be looking at. You're exactly right, Frank, including this family of IT folks from Pakistan who are now in trouble, potentially in trouble, who were working for Democrat members of Congress, and they have done things inappropriate with classified information. And here's the kicker. It's not just Republicans. Remember, Senator Dianne Feinstein, when asked, said that we should look into the Lynch Comey matter after his testimony a few weeks ago. Even Democrat Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, said we should look into this. So this is that critical. The American people want us to get answers to this, because most Americans care deeply about this fundamental concept, equal treatment under the law for every single American. Not special treatment because your last name is Clinton. Not special treatment because your husband was the president and you're the Secretary of State. Equal treatment under the law should be the standard.
Amen. Well, there can be no rule of law as a practical matter, as you know, Congressman, without that fundamental principle. Just on that House IT scandal, I'm constantly musing about the fact that if Republican members of the House of Representatives, 20 or more of them, were using a white supremacist group, let's say, just for the purpose of discussion, as a source of IT services, and we're doing so in some very squirrely ways, without much accountability. People weren't showing up to work, and on and on and on, as Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller has documented pretty assiduously. I can't conceive of a Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House giving that kind of a pass and waiting for the Capitol Police to sort out the facts. Why is the Congress, under the leadership of Paul Ryan, not holding hearings, if not on the substance of the problems that the police are looking into, the Capitol Police, at least the ethics questions, perhaps, the relationships that are so bizarre here with Pakistani nationals, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's frustrating for many of us why we don't push a little harder. I think the American people want us to push a little harder. American people want the truth. And the only way you get the truth sometimes is to have the hearings, ask the tough questions when people are under oath. I mean, after all, it was a hearing with James Comey under oath where we learned that he actually leaked a government memo through a friend to the New York Times, where we actually learned that the attorney general at the time, Loretta Lynch, told him to say something that wasn't accurate about an investigation to call in the matter when, in fact, the Clinton team was under investigation. So that's why you have the hearings, because that's where you learn important information, where people are brought in, sworn in, under oath. That's how you're supposed to do it. So I'm for having hearings, as many as we can, to get to the truth.
Good. Well, as a member of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, I pray that you're going to be able to help get that done. Listen, let me ask you very quickly, Congressman Jordan, you were one of 60 members of the House who recently wrote calling for Justice Ginsburg to recuse herself from involvement in the deliberations about the immigration pause. I think you feel, as do I, that this is really important. Where do you think that stands, and will she?
Well, we got the pretty good decision a few weeks ago. I mean, relative to her, I don't think so. But we point out in the letter that, you know, the code for judicial ethics says if it looks like any way there's some bias there, on that you cannot function in an impartial fashion, you're supposed to recuse yourself. Well, look at some of the statements that she made, Justice Ginsburg made, about then-candidate Donald Trump, now President Trump, and you're like, wow, that definitely calls into question her ability to remain impartial when evaluating and looking at the facts. Yeah, that's why you had 60 members sign. It wasn't just one or two members. It was 60 members of the House of Representatives said, look at this fact pattern. Look at what the ethics canons say, and look at what she said about then Canada Trump. So, but we'll see.
I hope you'll keep the heat on, Congressman Jim Jordan, as you're doing on so many of these in fronts and others that we can't even get to today. But thank you for taking the time with us and for your great leadership in the Freedom Caucus and in the House of Representatives and in Washington more generally. You are a swamp drainer, and we need one big time at the moment. Thank you, sir, for all you do.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we're joined once again by a friend and much admired colleague, a member of the Secure the Grid Coalition, and the chairman of an extraordinarily valuable organization, the Foundation for Resilient Societies. He is Tom Popick, a man who has a deep knowledge of the most pressing national security issue of our time, in my humble opinion, and that is the vulnerability of our electric grid. And I wanted to get Tom back on to talk about an incident that took place over the weekend in Los Angeles, in which some 140,000 people found themselves without power as the result of an as yet unexplained explosion, destructive loss of a high voltage transformer. These are the sorts of things Tom knows all about. I'm glad to have him back to discuss it. Tom, welcome. Good to have you, sir.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's really good to be on your show. So, yes, that incident did occur over the weekend. The LA Times is reporting it's a 230 kilovolt equipment. I'm assuming they mean the transformer by that. And so that would place it as part of what's called the bulk power system. That is the high voltage part of the U.S. electric grid. However, there are transformers with considerably higher voltage than that that would cover a much more customers.
What I'm interested in is, Tom, the role that these devices play in the grid. What is a transformer and how does it function in terms of getting that, as you say, bulk power distribution to operate?
Well, certainly. It's important to understand in the United States, power is generated oftentimes at great distances from where it's consumed. The power is carried along those great distances on high voltage transmission lines. And it's only efficient to transmit the power if the voltage is stepped up to a very high level. And then when it gets near the consumers, if the voltage is again stepped down. What steps the voltage up and steps the voltage down are transformers. These are really critical components for the electric grid. Without these transformers, the electric grid, in fact, can't function. And that's why we saw over 100,000 customers blacked out in Los Angeles over the weekend.
Tom, what are these things? I understand that they're as big as a two-story house in some cases, these high-voltage ones in particular. What's on their insides, and how hard is it to get your hands on them if you happen to have one explode on you?
Well, certainly. The major components of these transformers would be a steel core. And then surrounding the steel core, there are windings, which are copper wire looped around and around. And then the transformers are filled with oil. They have an oil tank, which keeps them cool because they're not 100% efficient. So some of the electricity turns into heat. The larger transformers will have radiators on top of them, much like a automobile would have a radiator to dissipate the heat.
Talk about first how hard it would be to take them out if one were of a mind to do so, Tom Popick, and how difficult it would be to replace them.
Well, first of all, it's not that difficult to take them out. Back in April of 2013, some terrorists attacked a substation just outside of San Jose, California, and used an AK-47 rifle to shoot out the radiators for 17 of these extra high voltage transformers. So even a rifle can, as you would say, take out the transformer. In terms of replacing the transformers, there's a couple issues. First, they're quite heavy. And so transporting them sometimes requires special arrangements on roadways or railroads. And second of all, many of the designs for these extra high voltage transformers are unique. They are no longer manufactured here in the United States. They're manufactured in Europe and in Asia. So the lead time to get the spares can often be in excess of a year. Now, fortunately, yeah, a lot of the circuits in the electric grid are designed to be redundant. They're designed to adjust if just one of these transformers is lost. But if large numbers of the transformers are lost, it really can present a long-term problem.
We're looking at the problem in this microcosmic example, what happened when 17 of these transformers were shot up outside of San Jose? Did they blow up as well? And if so, what was the effect?
Well, it's fortunate that they didn't blow up. There was telemetry for the transformers just outside of San Jose. The operators at the electric grid control room saw the transformers overheating and were able to shut off the power before the transformers overheated so much that they ended up they could have caught fire catastrophically. So,
and if they had, Tom, what would have been the effect in the area that was served by that important transformer substation?
Well, there would have been a long-term shortage of power for Silicon Valley and the city of San Francisco.
Long-term meaning more than 12 hours?
Well, I think that there would have been a month's long shortage of power.
Because it would take that long to put more of these transformers in place, assuming we had them to put in there, given, as you say, their unique design.
Correct. And it also turns out that the times of year where there's less electricity demand are the spring and the fall. And that particular attack occurred in the springtime. So it also occurred at 1 o'clock in the morning. And that's a time where there's less electricity demand as well. So,
Tom Popick, that's not the only way, of course, damage could be done to these transformers or for that matter, to the grid that they are sort of at the backbone of. Talk about cyber and electromagnetic pulse and even solar storms that may pose a similar risk.
Well, sure. All of those risks can cause electric grid outage and long-term electric grid outage. For example, solar storms can overload the transformers and cause them to burn out, in some cases, catch fire and explode. That's actually happened during or shortly after solar storms. Cyber attack can send surges of current through the system and burn out equipment without a doubt. And as we saw at the Metcalf substation outside of San Francisco, physical attack can also damage these transformers, which are quite critical to the electric grid.
Now, Tom Popick, you spoke, testified before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the group that is at least nominally supposed to be overseeing the grid and assuring that it's not only reliable but resilient against these kinds of attacks. On the 22nd of June, describe briefly what you told them about the dangers of a grid down situation, particularly over a wide area for a protracted period.
Certainly. What I testified about at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission was the threat of what's called a long-term outage. This would be an outage that wouldn't be restored in 12 hours, as the LA outage was over the weekend, but would take weeks or months to restore. And the reason why this is so significant is that a lot of other critical infrastructure is dependent upon continuous electric supply from the grid. And that's what makes this eventuality so disruptive to societal function.
This is a critically important piece of a much larger problem that you've been teaching me about and many of us. And I'm so grateful to you, Tom Popick, for your time and for the work you do at the Foundation for Resilient Societies. We'll be following this closely in the hope of really impressing upon not just the FERC, as it's called, but also the Trump administration, that this is an urgent matter that must be attended to, making sure that we secure our grid. Thank you, Tom. We'll talk with you again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio on matters involving Asia and American policy with regard to that important part of the world, most especially, but not restricted exclusively, to China, a country whose conversations at the summit, shall we say, seem to have been overshadowed by those that President Trump had with Vladimir Putin, but he also met on the margins of the G20 meeting last week with Xi Jinping, the president of China. To discuss that and much more, I'm very pleased to say we have a man who has been giving a lot of thought to these matters, notably in his book, The Coming Collapse of China, and of course in his terrific columns, which you can find at The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, and WorldAffairsJournal.com. It's so good to have you back, Gordon. Thank you for taking a few minutes to join us.
Thank you, Frank.
So let's talk a little bit about the meeting that took place between Xi and President Trump. Was there news coming out of it, or just simply more insights into the nature of that relationship?
It certainly was a long meeting, Frank. It was more than 90 minutes. And the important thing here is that it was almost entirely focused on North Korea. I think that the Trump administration no longer has a China policy. And that's a good thing, because for far too long, American administrations have elevated the integration of China into the international system over disarming North Korea. Now, it's for Trump, disarming North Korea is the number one policy in Asia, and he's subordinating his relations to China to North Korea, which means that we'll have friendly relations with Beijing if China helps, and we're not going to have friendly relations if it doesn't. And right now, after the meeting with Xi Jinping, it looks like we're not going to. And that's a good thing, because China has not been helping on North Korea. It's been working with Russia to frustrate us at places like the UN. And indeed, the Chinese are continuing their support of the North Korean economy. So, you know, as Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said on Air Force One, back from Hamburg at the G20, we had very direct discussions, as he put it, with the Chinese. And that's, of course, code for unfriendly talk.
Yeah. Frank exchange of views, I think, is the typical diplomatic parlance for that kind of conversation. But Gordon, I'm surprised to hear you say that in a way, because it does seem to me as though subordinating our China relationship to North Korea can mean that a dangerous adversary, I think, is what's emerging from Beijing, is not being considered as such, except through the prism of how they conduct themselves with respect to North Korea. Or is that an overstatement of what you're really saying?
Well, what's going on here is essentially that Trump has taken President Obama's advice that North Korea is America's number one security threat, and decided that really for the first time since 1994, the United States is going to place North Korea really at the center of our policy. In a sense, of course, our relations with China are multidimensional. They go well beyond North Korea. We've got predatory trade practices, cyber attacks, South China Sea, Taiwan, human rights, you name it. But because China won't help on North Korea, it means that we're going to take a much tougher posture on all of these other issues. And that's definitely a good thing. Also, because relations with Beijing are so difficult over North Korea, what we're doing right now is we are warming up our ties with New Delhi. You know, many people had been concerned, including me, that Trump was going to let trade irritants, immigration concerns, overwhelm the overarching strategic considerations of relations with New Delhi. Both George W. Bush and President Obama, to their great credit, improved and strengthened ties with New Delhi. And people worried that Trump wouldn't continue that initiative. Well, on June 26, when Prime Minister Narendra Modi went to the White House, we saw that Trump put him very much on the top of the list of American friends and allies. And that's a really good thing, because when you step back and look at this, as we've talked about before, when the world's most powerful democracy and its most populous one get together, they really have overwhelming advantage and leverage over China. And this is going to be a narrative that'll continue for quite some time. But the U.S. and India together, along with our other friends, Australia, Japan, Vietnam, you know, this is really an unbeatable combination. I left out South Korea intentionally because of Moon Jae-in, but of course that's just temporary. You know, we will wait out Moon, and the relationship will continue. But, you know, the United States has friends and allies in the region. The Chinese know it. They're becoming increasingly concerned. But this is their fault. They drove all of these countries into the arms of a very unwilling Bush administration and a very unwilling Obama administration. And so, you know, the Chinese have created this situation, and the United States, by almost doing nothing, became, again, the center of countries' desires and hopes in the region.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Gordon, that's a promising prognosis. Less promising, especially given what you've just said about the importance of the partnership between the United States and India, is something you touched on in your column in Forbes.com about China's next war possibly being with the Indians. Now, I don't know if you mean a full-out war or another of the border skirmishes that have taken place over the years between these two countries, but talk a little bit about what the Chinese have been up to and where that looks like it might be headed.
This, Frank, could very well be the next war. The two countries, China and India, fought a war in 1962, which the Chinese basically won. The border, though, between these two nations remains unsettled. The Chinese, over the course of years, have been probing Indian-controlled territory with incursions. And in the middle of June, the last incursion, most recent incursion, started where Chinese construction trucks, guarded by soldiers, started to build a road approaching Indian-controlled territory. This is in Bhutan, which is a sovereign nation, but which is closely allied with India. And Indian troops are now 120 meters apart from the Chinese in a standoff. This is something that the Indian policymakers are worried will turn into a full-scale war, because at this point, you have a Chinese ruler, Xi Jinping, very close to his 19th Party Congress later this year, can't back down. The Indians are not going to back down, as they should not, because they cannot allow the Chinese to probe territory controlled by others. So this is a standoff. It's going to last for quite some time. And the concern in New Delhi is that there will be an all-out shooting war between China and India.
It could get very ugly indeed. And in a way, that surprises me, Gordon, because it seemed as though the Chinese were focusing their efforts on expansionism in the South China Sea. It's hard to believe they would want to be strapping on potential challenges with the United States and the Indians, those two great democratic powers, as you say, simultaneously.
Yeah, well, this is really the folly of Chinese foreign policy. You know, Barbara Tuchman wrote that book about how countries do things that are against their interests. Well, you know, China looks very aggressive. It's gotten some gains through aggressiveness, but those gains, I think, are temporary for the most part. And indeed, what they've done longer term is they've created a coalition against it. You know, in the past, Chinese troops have incurred deep into Indian-controlled territory, but they have withdrawn. And the hope is that we're going to see the same thing in Doklam, which is where this most recent controversy is. But there is concern in New Delhi that this incursion looks different than prior ones. And that's why at this point there is, you know, alarm in Asia over this.
Well, as you say, history is replete with examples of countries not only doing things contrary to their interests, but miscalculating what the response of others might be. It may well be that this has something to do with Xi's upcoming party congress. You follow these things extraordinarily closely, Gordon, and enlighten all of us about them. We are deeply grateful for your doing so and look forward to resuming this conversation with you next week. Next up, Dan Perkins joins us, a best-selling author, notable in his expertise about things like the Middle East and Qatar. What is up with that? Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dan Perkins, a man who has demonstrated considerable ability in a whole host of areas. He is a former communicator in the United States Army. He is a man who has been hugely successful in the business of money management, and most recently as a best-selling author, including several books of note. The Brotherhood of the Red Nile is one of a series that is now complemented by a new Ted Baker novel, In Terrorist Gold. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with him about particularly the Middle East, a subject of considerable interest to both of us, and to welcome him back. Dan, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you again.
So, Dan, one of the things that, of course, is playing out, and you've given a lot of thought to the nature of the enemies that we're dealing with in and out of the Middle East, is the nation of Qatar, a nation that is now at dagger's points with a number of its, other partners in the Gulf Cooperation Council, cozying up to the Iranians and certainly enabling the Muslim Brotherhood and a host of terrorist organizations. And yet, the United States government can't seem to make up its mind whether they're friend or foe. What do you think?
I think that the situation where we had Egypt and Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern nations cutting ties with Qatar, I think is a direct result of Mr. Trump's most recent trip to the Middle East when he spoke to those 50 delegates to that meeting in Riyadh. And while he didn't specifically call for a boycott of Qatar, in his public posturing, I do believe that behind the scenes, there were comments by Mr. Trump and his Secretary of State about Qatar seems to be the one country that is a dichotomy in a Middle Eastern complex, which is desperately starved for capital, seeing a tremendous change in their culture and their economy because of the decline in the price of crude oil. And yet they are probably one of the greatest harbinger of terrorism in the Middle East. So the isolation of Qatar by the leading countries in the Middle East it says that when the president asked the Arab nations to begin to deal with the issue of terrorism from the Middle East on their own, this is the first reaction. And it was a relatively quickly after that conference that they took a position.
Yeah. You know, you're that's such an interesting point, Dan Perkins. The president, of course, did say in that public setting, drive them out, when he was talking about extremists. Of course, some of us were thinking about his hosts as well as the Qataris. But there certainly is a logic to the idea that when he was speaking to those Sunni Arab nations and other Muslim states, that what he was looking for was this kind of corrective by them of one of their own, who has been extraordinarily aggressive in promoting the Brotherhood and otherwise, you know, enabling terrorism against some of them as well as us.
And it was what was interesting to me about the whole situation is that for 8 years, America told the world that we no longer wanted to lead from the front. What we would lead from the back. And a world without America as a primary leader is a very dangerous world. And we have seen the cost of human life and destruction of property, as we had a president who refused to engage in the world stage in leading the world. Mr. Trump came in. Not only did he change the American psyche to a positive from a negative after 8 years of Barack Obama, but his action in Syria with the nerve gas and the attack on the airbase in short order after the attack was done, that was an example of impractical reality. There was nobody else in the world to do what he did. And if he didn't do it, nobody else was going to do it. I think that what's important is that the world has been leaderless, and without leaders, it created an opportunity for bad guys to take over the control of the world.
Well, I guess the way I would qualify that is the good guys have been leaderless, or the relatively good guys, certainly. And you're right, the vacuum has been filled by others who are very hostile. You know, the reason I'm drilling down on this point about Qatar is it does seem as though, presumably because we've got an important military installation there and other equities, that the State Department, the Defense Department has been actually sort of taking the side of the Qataris. The president has been much, much more robust about the problem that they represent. Is that just a good cop, bad cop deal, do you think, or is there a real division within the administration on it?
No, I think it's a great way to describe the strategy. You got Tillerson from the State Department saying one thing, and the president saying what he wants to say. But if you think about it, state and defense have been relatively quiet about the reaction of what's going on in the Middle East as it relates to Qatar. They could have been a lot more vocal, but they have been fairly quiet, and the president has been somewhat the point person on this, but these cabinet secretaries and obviously their staffs are working, but they're not, they have a very low profile. You're right. We have an important base there. But they were the country, lest we forget, they were the country where many of the Guantanamo prisoners were released to, and then disappeared, and Qatar had no ability to seem to follow them, yet the administration kept sending more and more prisoners to Qatar, too.
Including the Taliban Five, as I recall. Plus, we've been turning a blind eye to the support that they are giving to the Muslim Brotherhood through, among other things, Yusuf al-Qaradawi, their sort of jurisprudential leader, and, of course, Al Jazeera, the kinds of things that the Saudis and the Egyptians and others have said have to stop. And boy, I'll tell you what, if we could actually see that agenda implemented, I think it would be a very signal and promising development in the Middle East. Let me ask you about this, the problem here as well, Dan Perkins. Again, you've written about the Brotherhood. You understand them, I think, probably as well as anybody. Should they be designated as a terrorist organization by the United States?
Absolutely. They should, without question. They should be identified as a terrorist organization. They are a terrorist organization. And they do not support the values of what we support, at least today, as a nation. And in some respects, even the people of the Middle East, for example, look what happened when the Brotherhood took over in Egypt, how quickly they were turned out because the people of Egypt said, wait a minute, this is not what we want to do.
Specifically, Sharia supremacism, I think, is pretty unappealing when you have it staring you in the face. And we better open our eyes to that being the agenda here as well. Dan Perkins, there's so much more to talk about. I hope we can get you back on soon. Your writings and your work, especially, let me just commend to this audience and to everyone the efforts that you're making on behalf of our wounded and injured men and women in uniform with your Songs and Stories for Soldiers.us initiative. I look forward to talking with you more about that when we get you back, hopefully in the very near future. In the meantime, stay well, keep up the terrific work you're doing.
to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's good to have with us a colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, the director of its Threat Information Office, an indispensable resource for those seeking information about the challenge we're facing, particularly from the enemy within, that is, the Sharia supremacists in our own nation, doing business as the Muslim Brotherhood or its assorted fronts or otherwise. He is Kyle Scheidler. Prior to joining the center, he was the director for research and communications at another terrific group, the Endowment for Middle East Truth. You can follow Kyle at Scheidler K. That is at Scheidler, S-H-I-D-E-L-E-R-K. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, it's always a pleasure to be on with you.
I wanted to ask you most immediately about a woman who is getting a huge amount of celebrity, and fortunately not all of it is fawning and sycophantic and sort of willfully blind. Notably, when Linda Sarsour spoke at the Islamic Society of North America conference in Chicago, I believe it was recently, she called attention to some of her very extreme Sharia supremacist views in a way that ought to cause everyone to have a second look at whether this is a gal that you want to consider a leader of anything, let alone women in America. Talk a little bit about the ISNA conference and what she said there.
So it was pretty remarkable. Linda Sarsour attended the ISNA conference, where she was speaking for an honorary luncheon for a man named Saeed Saeed, who was like a major founder of the Islamic Society of North America. He was also a founder of many other Muslim Brotherhood organizations in the United States. And she praised him for his role in establishing the infrastructure of the Brotherhood in the United States, although obviously she didn't use those words. She then pivoted to discussing what she described as a jihad against Donald Trump and white supremacists and fascists in the White House. And she explicitly compared this jihad against Trump to the struggles against tyrants and rulers in the Middle East. So she was making a direct comparison there between Donald Trump and the sort of Arab secular rulers of the Middle East that they have waged jihad against.
And by jihad, that we should be clear, in that context, there's very little doubt that it's not just speaking truth to power, but it's actually seeking the overthrow of those rulers, as we saw in the so-called Arab Spring, right?
Well, that's what was so interesting about this, is that media outlets on the left and even a handful on the right really rushed to Sarsour's defense, saying, well, you know, she's talking about speaking truth to power. It doesn't mean violent jihad. But what's so interesting is that if you look at the language that Sarsour used, she explicitly uses the phrase oppressors and oppression when referring to her jihad against Trump. Now, this is important because in the Islamic legal context under Sharia, jihad against oppressors is done by essentially three ways. One, by a physical jihad, that is to say fighting. Two, by the jihad of the tongue, which is to say speaking out or engaging in dawah activity. And then three is a jihad of the heart, where jihadi is supposed to maintain hatred in his heart for the oppressors. So Sarsour is making a reference to jihad, which from the legal doctrine is explicitly a jihad, which includes violence. And she would know that, and her audience at ISNA certainly knew that.
Most of us are completely oblivious to it, and as a result are often, I think, seduced by sort of the favorable press that people like Linda Sarsour, a prominent fixture now in Brotherhood circles, often gets. Which leads me to another organization, one of the Islamic societies that make up the Islamic Society of North America, namely the Islamic Society of Baltimore. There is an upcoming event taking place there, and I wanted to ask you about it. I'm told that the Baltimore County Executive, Kevin Kamenetz, is planning to be there with others on the left. Khazir Khan of the Democratic National Committee convention fame, the NAACP. But specifically, talk a little bit, Kyle, about this Islamic Society of Baltimore and the so-called Greater Baltimore Muslim Council, of which it's a leading element.
Well, the Baltimore County Executive is having what they're calling a call for unity. And it's interesting that they would include the Islamic Society of Baltimore in that, because if there's one thing that the Islamic Society of Baltimore has been for, it isn't unity. If you take a look at the president and the imam of the Islamic Society of Baltimore, a man named Muhammad Adam El-Sheikh. Now, El-Sheikh was a co-founder of the Muslim American Society, which federal prosecutors described as the overt arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. He explicitly has been described as a member of the Sudanese Muslim Brotherhood, and he replaced Anwar al-Awlaki, the al-Qaeda leader, at the Muslim Brotherhood-led Dar al-Hijra Mosque in Falls Church, Virginia. Now, he was also the regional leader for an organization called the Islamic American Relief Agency. Now, that's a group that the Treasury Department designated as a terrorist group because of their ties to the Afghan Services Bureau, which was the precursor to al-Qaeda. So this is a man that has deep ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and even ties to an organization designated as a terrorist group. Now, the Islamic Society of Baltimore has used its action alerts in the past to send out calls for donations to Mujahideen in Chechnya. So this is a group that really no one has any business associating with.
That's the height of irresponsibility when it comes to public officials. Like the Baltimore County Executive, he should certainly know better. I was noting that some of your research indicates that the Washington Post has called attention to the fact that this El-Sheikh fellow has admonished his congregation that there are, quote, exceptions, unquote, to the rule against suicide bombings in Islamic law. And interestingly enough, his defense parallels that of Yusuf al-Qaradawi, one of the preeminent Muslim brothers. These are guys who are clearly playing for the other team, Kyle Scheidler, and it would seem to me very, very alarming, really, that public officials would be legitimating them by their presence in their facilities.
Well, I would think so. And you know, Frank, it's worth pointing out that, as you said, the Washington Post has covered some of these guys and what they have said in the past. So it's not just a conservative versus left issue. This is really on the record at mainstream publications as to who these guys are and what they believe. And the reality is that you have a group that, since former President Barack Obama went to this mosque in order to make his appeal, they've been totally legitimated. And so it's very difficult for us to raise issues about what they really believe and the activities that they have really been engaged in. And this is problematic, not just from a national security perspective, but I would think from a liberal perspective, from groups like the NAACP, the fact that they're going to be attending a mosque whose imam and resident scholar has called for violent rhetoric against homosexuals ought to cause them problems with their own constituency.
Kyle, I appreciate your work tremendously at the Center for Security Policy, also your periodic guest hosting for me at this program. So you're welcome both as a guest and as a host. Thanks for all you do with the Threat Information Office at the Center for Security Policy, Kyle Scheidler. I hope the rest of you will be willing to return tomorrow for this program's continuation. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.